Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, which will launch an RN to BSN program in January. Practicing nurses with an associate degree can complete a Bachelor of Science in Nursing in just 16 months, taking a mix of online and on-campus courses. For more information, go to carthage.edu/BSN. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's morning show is coming about because of my colleague and friend, Len Iaquinta, who, of course, is one of the very able hosts of our weekend program, Community Matters. And Len Iaquinta recently reached out to me with a suggestion that I am very excited about. He was inviting onto Community Matters someone who was a classmate of his in graduate school, a man by the name of Barry Jagoda, who was a special TV advisor to then-Governor Jimmy Carter, and then became a special assistant to President Jimmy Carter. And this came after years of distinguished work for both CBS News and NBC News. And his wide-reaching career, which continues to this very day, is chronicled in fascinating fashion in a new memoir called Journeys with Jimmy Carter and Other Adventures in Media, published by Kohler Books. And I appreciate the far-reaching scope of this fascinating book, which really takes us inside the intriguing life and career of its author. Barry Jagoda, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And I appreciate your mentioning the title of my memoir, although the title was suggested by my publisher. He thought that that might attract a wide audience. This book is really more of a lifetime presentation of mine. It's a memoir with sections, of course, including the Carter presidency, but also with roots in rising in Texas and New York City and working as a producer for Walter Cronkite's Apollo 11 coverage and subsequent Emmy Award-winning work on Watergate.
Right. So this reaches well beyond the work that you did for Jimmy Carter, and that's one of the things that I really do appreciate about this book is certainly its scope. One thing that is said at one point along the way is that you have written this book after 60 years in the media business, both reporting and making news. I wonder if you could take us inside those intriguing words that your career has included both reporting and making news, and how valuable it is for somebody to have experience on both sides of that equation.
Well, thank you for that that opening. You know, I have observed over the years, people often say, well, this is discussed in my book. And I often thought that that was just a kind of marketing ploy. But really, if someone somehow is able to write something down in the form of a book, sometimes the material as written does get inscribed or etched in one's brain. And so it's not necessarily bragging about a book, but just reflecting on what is one is written. I have only in the recent years had a chance to sit back and think about my work, my career in journalism and politics. And because I had some time after a long career, I was able to take a year and set all this down in this book, Journeys with Jimmy Carter and Other Adventures in Media. So, you know, I'm not precisely sure where to start, but I guess what might catch one's attention is the work in the Carter presidency. And that came about because when Governor Carter was seeking the presidency in the 1970s, he and his principal media advisor, Jody Powell, who became press secretary to the president, realized they didn't really know that much about television. And I came along. Actually, it wasn't really coming along. The distinguished broadcast journalist, Ed Bradley, who made his fame on 60 Minutes, was covering the Carter campaign. And I think Powell said to Bradley one day, you know, we really don't know that much about TV. Got any ideas on who might help us? So I could take the story from there. But as I say, it's written down in the memoir.
Right. I want to ask you real quick. I thought that was really kind of intriguing that Jody Powell, press secretary to Governor Jimmy Carter, the future President Carter, said so freely, we don't know much about TV. That just seems like an interesting admission for somebody who's a press secretary. I mean, isn't that part of what a press secretary does? Or was this back in an era in which television didn't necessarily figure as prominently? Or is it a time when television was emerging as being especially significant, and so they're trying to kind of catch up? I was just surprised that somebody who was somebody's press secretary would, in a sense, not know more about the television business.
Well, you know, it's a great observation you make. Carter came out of nowhere. He was known as Jimmy Who, as you'll recall. He had been governor of Georgia, and in that role as governor of Georgia, of course, the local media in Georgia, particularly in Atlanta, was around. And but that was basically most of the about all the exposure that Carter and Powell had to television. And so it was an opportunity for both me and for Carter to get in more in depth in television. And actually, one day, after Bradley mentioned to Powell that he might get some help from me, Carter was up in won New Hampshire in 1976, and he was up in had just won Iowa in 1976, and he was up in New Hampshire, and Powell invited me to come up there. And I did, and we had a drink at a bar and chatted for an hour or so. And then Powell said, well, maybe you should talk to the boss. So Governor Carter did find a little time for me, and we chatted. And the first question he asked me, he said, well, how would you change me? And I sort of had thought about this because some people had said that Carter mumbled and was not as articulate as he could be. And I said, well, Governor, I wouldn't try to change you. I would just let you know what the impact of what you might say or do would have on the news, on broadcast journalism particularly, but on all the major publications. And that really appealed to the guy's ego. He said, uh-huh, okay. And he called Powell over and said, well, maybe this guy can help us if he wants to. So that's how I got involved.
Right. So that you had a good answer, or an impressive answer. And I got to say, I'm impressed with then Governor Carter's question to you. I mean, what an intelligent question for him to ask, and it's a question you fielded well. You write, as you're describing this moment in your life and this career, that philosophically it was hard for you to think about making this shift and becoming, in your words, a booster for any politician. I mean, up until this point, you had for the most part been a journalist, where it was not part of the job description to be out there trying to boost one candidate or one official over another. Tell us more about what you had to sort of come to grips with in terms of getting comfortable with the idea of, in a sense, leaving behind your life as a journalist and making this step into a very different sort of public arena.
Well, it's a good question. Of course, you know, people who are trained in journalism often are skeptics and cast a cold eye on, particularly on politicians, people who are making promises and such. But I had had 10 good years in broadcasting after Lynn Iaquinta and I had gotten our master's degree at Columbia University. And I went on to NBC News and CBS News. It was a very fertile time. I eventually became a producer for Walter Cronkite's Apollo 11 coverage and then got an Emmy Award for work on Watergate. So after 10 good years, I was kind of thinking, well, is this going to continue? There must be more. And it was at that time that I was sort of thinking about some entrepreneurial activity and mulling over what might come after journalism. And that's when Bradley suggested to Powell that he might invite me up there. It was really a gamble on my part. You know, this guy was really unknown. And I was leading a great career in broadcast journalism. So I thought about it long and hard. And I said, well, why not try this? You know, why not take this adventure? And it turned out to be a pretty good adventure, because what was really going on was once a candidate tends to win in a primary election, this in itself is an invitation for media coverage. So I came along about the time that Carter was became a star, and I knew the background of how to manage this stardom, if you will, because I had, you know, in the previous 8 years had covered aspiring politicians and knew what that amounted to. So actually a great moment for me in the transition. I joined up with Carter, and coming after his win first in Iowa and then in New Hampshire, I remember so vividly the outstanding New York Times reporter who was then covering Carter, Jim Wooten. He was James Wooten. Bradley was there. Wooten was there. And after Carter won, as we were driving off to an interview that I had set up with Cronkite and the other anchors, Wooten came along and he knocked on the window and he rolled down the window and he said, Governor, I think you've just won the nomination. And Carter had been working on this for a long time, and he looked up and said, good deal, Jim. Thank you very much. And we went on, and it turned out that Wooten was right on that, as he had been so often and in his career as a great print journalist.
Hmm. We're speaking with Barry Jagoda and talking about his book Journeys with Jimmy Carter and Other Adventures in Media. The book chronicles not only Mr. Jagoda's long career in journalism with both CBS News and NBC News, but also his work as a media advisor for Governor Jimmy Carter and then a special assistant in the White House to President Jimmy Carter. During that campaign in which Jimmy Carter was challenging the incumbent president, Gerald Ford, one of the most significant duties that you had was to help prepare Jimmy Carter for his televised debate with Gerald Ford. And I think one of the most interesting moments in the book is when you talk about some of the behind-the-scenes logistics that were involved in safeguarding your own candidate, and that Mr. Carter could be, in a sense, presented in as positive a frame as possible, even before the first word was spoken in that debate. Tell our listeners about some of those details that that you and other advisors to Governor Carter were thinking about and taking care of.
Well, it's a good question. You know, in 1976, there was the probability of presidential debates. Such activity had not been undertaken since the great historical debate in 1960, several debates between then incumbent president, between then Vice President Nixon and the Democratic challenger, John Kennedy. So there had to be a reason for both candidates in a potential debate, presidential or in other venues, for having a debate in the first place. And in 76, the president, the incumbent president, Gerald Ford, had only been in office less than a year, having succeeded as a vice president to Nixon when Nixon left the office in the Watergate aftermath. And Carter, as an unknown, also wanted to get the airtime and debate. So you had two candidates who wanted to debate, the genial and rather pleasant incumbent president, Ford, and the would-be challenger, Jimmy Carter. So it was agreed that there would be debates, and there was actually set up to make sure that candidates wouldn't try to dodge them, something called the Commission on Presidential Debates, and both campaigns, the Ford campaign and the Carter effort, were called to have meetings to discuss how the candidates would debate. Our own real great concern was and opportunity was to have the incumbent have the challenger, rather, Carter, on an equal footing on a debate stage with Ford. There were some really what seems now rather mundane or issues. Ford was, I guess, about 6'1", and Carter was only 5'8". And we were very concerned to start with that we didn't want to have Ford overshadow physically our candidate. And that was just one issue. But basically, we wanted to have a stage where our candidate was seen on an equal footing with the president. We didn't want to have podiums with the signs that said Office of the President and that sort of thing. It would be a neutral stage. And that's what we worked on. There were six advisors, three from the Ford side and three from our side, who met repeatedly. And after wrangling and thinking about this and working it through, we did finally get agreement on the staging of the presidential debates in 1976. It turned out to be very significant because in these debates, then and now, one of the things that the observers, the political class, if you forgive the expression, journalists and such, pay attention to is if somebody makes a mistake, and if there's a gaffe of one sort or another, that tends to be remembered. And that's what happened in 1976. In the second debate, President Ford mentioned that there was no Soviet domination of several of the countries in Eastern Europe. And Carter heard that and said, well, you might try to tell the Czech Americans or the Polish Americans that there's no Soviet domination. Actually, I've been thinking about this and reading about this recently. There was the emerging, coming toward the end of the Cold War, and Ford was not wrong. It just was politically wrong. So sometimes what in terms of policy might make sense might have run into problems with politics, and that's what happened in the 1976 debates. Hmm.
Well, of course, we all know by now that that Jimmy Carter was victorious over incumbent Gerald Ford and became president, and you were asked to stay on as a special assistant in the White House to President Carter, very much still involved in matters related to the media and the way in which President Carter was, in a sense, connecting with the American public. Was your position one that already existed, or in a sense, was this a position created for you? I guess another way to think about it is, would you have had predecessors in the White House whose focus was the focus that you were given as special assistant to President Carter?
Well, you know, again, you've touched on an interesting question. The great chronicler of presidential elections, Theodore H. White, he had written in 1960 the book Making the President in 1960 and went on every 4 years to chronicle this. I'm almost embarrassed to say that White said that Jagoda was Jimmy Carter's secret weapon in the 76 campaign. And as it turned out, there had not really been that much focus on television in previous White Houses. And the new president, President Carter, named 14 assistants and special assistants, and I was one of them, to come on to help with media relations and other duties such as cultural and artistic activities, working closely with the president's advance team. So it was largely a media relations job, but also anytime television came up, I got involved in it, and that was very interesting, very rewarding, and so it was relatively new. Actually, very often, when there would be some event, which was called a television event, I'd get called in and was a staff member. Just a quick, brief piece of history. You know, Jimmy Carter was a midshipman at the United States Naval Academy, and when he graduated, he was in the middle of the class. He wanted to go into the submarine corps. And anybody who wanted to become a submariner had to be interviewed by the very rigorous-minded head of the submarine program, Admiral Hyman Rickover. So in that interview that Carter had with Rickover, Rickover said to Carter, "Have you always done your best?" And Carter, being a relatively honest guy, said, "Well, no, I guess I haven't." And Rickover said, "Why not your best?" Which became the title of Carter's campaign book, Why Not Your Best. And so then after the election, when Carter was president a few months into the administration, maybe 6 months or so, Carter invited Admiral Rickover to come to the White House. And Rickover did, and then they together, using a new piece of electronic technology, pushed a button and launched a submarine from the White House in Groton, Connecticut. And that was very interesting. Of course, Carter had a lot of things on his mind, and even though he was proud to have his mentor, former mentor, Rickover there, once the deed was done, Carter went on to wherever he had to go, and Rickover's standing there looking around, said, "Where is Jimmy?" And, of course, Carter was gone, and Rickover said, "Well, I've got these papers," and he looked around, he trusted him. Bunch of papers to me, and I said, "I'll be sure that the president gets these papers." And I sent them on to the staff secretary, Rick Hutchison by name, and like so many, lots and lots of material was given to the staff secretary for selection for the president to read overnight. And that was a Rickover story that I've always treasured.
Hmm. One of the things that we remember so vividly from the Carter years, I mean, those of us old enough to have been around and to directly recall those events, is that first time that President Carter was on television and wearing a sweater. And you would have had at least some hand in some of those choices that were made in terms of what that television presentation to the American public was all about. Remind us what President Carter was anxious to achieve with that, and explain what you had to do with matters like President Carter wearing a sweater instead of a suit, and choices like that. What was behind some of those choices that were made in terms of the way President Carter would present himself to the American people?
Greg, again, it's a very good question. The new president wanted to, had promised when he ran for president, to stay in close touch with the American people. And so thinking back to FDR's fireside chat, that was the first major event reaching out to the public. And what Carter had in mind was to talk about energy conservation, and which was at that time, you know, of course, a very important topic. And so we decided that a good way to do that was to have them sit in front of a fireplace, and because you know, that would instead of wearing a suit and standing at a podium, sitting in front of a fireplace would be a good opportunity to talk about energy conservation. When we were a few days before the talk, the fireside chat, several of us were gathered around by the fireplace there, and someone said, "Well, what are you going to wear, Mr. President?" And his wife, Rosalynn Carter, who's very, very much directly involved in all of these activities, said, "Well, why don't you just wear that sweater that Chip got for Christmas?" And Chip Carter, the second of Carter's three sons. And so that was the idea, and that's what happened. Carter put on the sweater, and he sat by the fireplace, and that caused a lot of consternation in the why wasn't the president properly dressed and such. But so that was the first big outreach. And then there was another, Carter had said to me, "Listen, let's be sure we develop programs to stay in touch with the American people." And I called up my old colleagues at CBS News and said, "What would you think about a radio program?" So after the fireside chat, there was something called, what was it called, Conversations with the President. Walter Cronkite hosted Jimmy Carter, and 42 million people called in with questions. And actually, at the time, I guess it was more than 42, it was about 50 million, and 42 questions were taken out of that on a wide variety of topics, and it worked out very well because that was a good example of Carter relating directly to the American people. And that worked out very well. So those first two activities, the fireside chat and the radio call-in, I actually have taken the full transcript of the radio call-in and added it as an appendix to my book. This, as the history has sort of forgotten the details of that call-in, but that's one of the things that I'm very proud of in this memoir.
Right.
Appendix.
I think I'm so glad that that's there, and it sort of reminds us of how extraordinary that event was. As far as I know, there's never been one like it, versus, for instance, the carefully orchestrated town hall meetings that have occurred since that are not at all the same sort of direct line to the president that this event was. Truly extraordinary. Something else I want to ask you about in this portion of the book where you talk about President Carter is that it seems that one of the things that was most important to you was that President Carter remain faithful to himself. That is, that he should remain who he really was and not pretend to be somebody that he wasn't. And you go so far as to say that, in your opinion, one of the keys to his impact was his vulnerability, his willingness to be vulnerable. And this eventually became at odds with other advisors a little further into the Carter presidency, who were feeling like a more sort of polished and focused presence needed to be cultivated before the American public. Tell us more about this matter of vulnerability and why you think that was so important in terms of who Jimmy Carter was.
Well, you asked the question in an important way. You know, so often candidates for public office and office holders think they have to get directly on message two or three items that they could repeat, and the public, based on polls and whatever, would want to hear. I had always thought that one of the great strengths, maybe the greatest strength of Jimmy Carter, was his lightning mind. He was very smart, and he could take questions on any topic and have a good policy answer, which was also a good political answer. But I ran into some philosophical differences with some of the other advisors who felt that Carter should be focused on just his messaging. And but I thought we were very fortunate to have a guy whose mind worked so well. Actually, you know, just recently, Carter, at age 95, was asked about, would you like to run for president again, Mr. President? And Carter said, you know, to be president, you have to have a mind which is facile and able to deal with a wide variety of topics. And he said, I think I'm a little too old for that. But back when he was president, I thought he was terrific in being able to deal with almost any question that would come up in an intelligent way. And I pushed that very hard. Hmm. As a matter of fact, I pushed it so hard that I ran into some conflict with some of the other advisors, and that eventually led me to leave the White House after a pretty good tenure there.
Right. One of the people you ended up, in a sense, sort of rubbing against when it came to this matter was Jimmy Carter's own wife, the first lady, Rosalynn Carter. What is it like to be in that kind of disagreement with someone as important as the first lady?
Well, you know, I should have spoken with Rosalynn about this before it became a real conflict. You know, she was terrific. When I first got involved with the Carter people, I was invited to I was told to come into the Carter home in the Plains and see the candidate. And I did. And there in the kitchen, Mrs. Carter was just getting ready to go to a softball game. And she invited me to come along, and we had a terrific relationship. I thought she was very strong, very wise. Carter thought of her as a good barometer of the American people. But she thought a couple of years into the administration that Carter was being overexposed, too vulnerable, and I became the target of that overexposure. But I would otherwise say she was terrific. You know, these first ladies, we now had many first ladies since then, and they all have different attributes, but Rosalynn Carter was strong and protective of her husband.
Hmm. Well, what's kind of intriguing to think about is how well does it work for somebody like Jimmy Carter to be president? And does it work for the president to be somebody who has the kind of mind that Jimmy Carter did? You quote in your book a famous, famous line about Jimmy Carter in comparison to the man who ultimately unseated him and became his successor, Ronald Reagan. Jim Fallows said, Carter had 50 solutions to problems, but Reagan had only one slogan. And of course, we all know who won that election. I mean, is it possible to be a successful president when you are the former, where with 50 solutions to every problem versus something that is succinct and has staying power? In retrospect, do you wish that Jimmy Carter had tried to adapt himself, or would that have just been impossible?
Well, I'm glad you asked the question. Jim Fallows is now one of our country's leading journalists. Then was, as it turns out, was a speechwriter for Carter, and he was an eyewitness to all this. I think that each president, each office holder has their own unique characteristics, of course. And it was not merely that Carter spoke out on many different topics as president. Toward the end of his tenure, of course, we can remember that there were hostages taken in Iran, that there was inflation was up to over 20%, and this was a very tough environment for an incumbent president to defend, particularly when you had Ronald Reagan, who had run for president and who, with his movie star background and his amenable smile, was looking for morning in America. And Carter realized that it was not so simple. So that led to his defeat. And after Carter's service in the White House, it was not clear what he was going to do. But he wisely created the Carter Center and focused on eradicating disease and trying to come up with fair elections all around the world. And Carter's well known for it, as much as for a post-presidency as for his service in the White House.
Well, ultimately, one of the badges of your success, or I should say your significance in the White House, is the fact that you ended up, in a sense, being featured in Jerry Trudeau's marvelous comic strip, Doonesbury. I mean, a character in that comic strip, as President Carter took office, who was known as the Secretary of Symbolism. And it was clearly a character clearly drawn in parallel to you. And I appreciate that you even include one example from a number of amusing Doonesbury comic strips that featured President Carter's Secretary of Symbolism. In a sense, is that a fair assessment of the Carter presidency, that there was a tremendous concern about and preoccupation with symbolism? And is that something that is important? Or is symbolism something that can sometimes distract us from matters that are even more important?
Well, you know, that concept of symbolism can be overrated. In fact, if there's not the policy to go along with such media inventions as symbolism, you get in big trouble. I was amused to see that Trudeau had put that in a comic strip. And yes, it can be overrated, those kinds of distractions, because after all, the presidency is so important in our lives as citizens in America, and important around the world. And so we've seen what can happen if a president goes off on his own, as we've seen in the recent past 4 years, when you had President Trump, who basically didn't listen to anybody except himself. And Trump has had pretty good instincts, if not merely symbolic. You know, in this recent election, 70 million people voted for Donald Trump, which was astonishing. The second largest number of people who have voted in a presidential election, only in the 2020, topped by when it was 75 million citizens who voted for Joe Biden. And, of course, that's interesting and important, but it's not nearly as important as winning the Electoral College.
I'll give you a chance to say a little bit more about President Trump in a moment. I want to be sure that I have a chance to circle back and say that your book is about your entire career in the media, including the work you did for CBS News and NBC News, and including the work that you did in helping to produce CBS's coverage of Apollo, and specifically the landing on the moon with Apollo 11. I just wonder, as you were helping shape CBS's coverage of something so momentous, I mean, one of the greatest stories in human history, I mean, how does one not sort of shrink away paralyzed, I mean, so intimidated by the prospects of covering something so momentous? I mean, what kinds of things were you weighing in trying to decide how best to capture this extraordinary moment?
Well, you know, I was very, very fortunate. I had a good background in training as a young guy, and then going to Columbia Graduate School of Journalism and getting hired at NBC News. When I was a young writer at NBC News, the top guy who was to eventually cover the Apollo program noticed that he needed somebody to take the rather difficult overnight trick, we called it, to monitor the early Apollo program. And I got that assignment. So I had learned something about the Apollo program. And then the guy who was in charge of CBS News' coverage of Man on the Moon knew that I had had some background and I was interviewed and got that really got very fortunate, got lucky to be the producer, the hard news producer down in the Johnson Space Center in Houston, looking for what might go right, what might go wrong. Walter Cronkite was very concerned about the details, being a hard news reporter behind his great broadcast skills. And so I'd been, in some ways, one had, I got lucky enough to be in my late 20s and early 30s, got some journalistic assignments, which some people, you know, don't have that opportunity in their whole life. And so I had, unlike so many people who were involved with Carter, I'd already had 10 years of excitement. And at age 32, I was one of the older veterans in the Carter White House. So I'd been there, and I was not as much in awe, I guess, of the White House, although I remember so well that on the day of the Carter inauguration, I was standing on the White House lawn with my colleague from the campaign, a wonderful guy by the name of Rex Graneman. We kind of looked around and said, is this true? Can we actually be doing this? So, I guess having been climbing halfway up the mountain as a broadcast journalist, getting all the way to the top was exciting and wonderful. I wasn't as overtaken by it as I might have been had I not already had terrific experiences.
Right. You quote at one point CBS's legendary Fred Friendly saying that journalism or journalists are, in effect, a 1,000-pound pencil. Do you remember him saying that? And can you explain what's behind those intriguing words?
Well, absolutely. Fred Friendly had become an important producer in American culture with having served as the producer for See It Now and weren't there as a top producer, and then was selected as president of CBS News. And he actually Friendly used that term, 1,000-pound pencil, because, of course, at that time in the 50s and 60s, if you were a journalist, a broadcast journalist, so you had to have a crew of three or four people, and before you turned around, all that gear and all those people weighed more than 1,000 pounds, as opposed to a print reporter who needed a notepad and a pencil or a pen. So that's what the 1,000-pound pencil meant. And you mentioned Friendly. He had a dispute with CBS News about covering hearings, Watergate hearings, and he left CBS News and came to Columbia Journalism School, and Len Iaquinta and 70 or 80 other of us were in that first Friendly class of broadcast journalists. That's kind of what propelled so many of us into broadcasting as opposed to print.
Hmm. So you do talk about President Donald Trump in your book, and one of the things you refer to repeatedly is what at one point you call President Trump's dishonest use of media. And you call this a fundamental threat to our daily lives. What is at the heart of what you see as President Trump's dishonest use of media?
Well, you know, it's easier to talk about this now that Trump has been defeated and we have a new president, but the Washington Post, I think, cataloged over 20,000 lies told by Trump during his incumbency. And I mentioned, I guess I tallied up to 13 or 14,000 lies in my book. The problem is if an office holder just spouts off whatever they want to without any foundation or any tie to reality or truth, what begins to set in is a disbelief in anything and from these office holders, and that I think is what we had finally in the Trump presidency. So I was a partisan, a never Trumpster, I guess. But the part of me which had been trained as a journalist could not leave behind an effort to try to stay, quote, objective, unquote. And that was very difficult with in the case of Trump, who, when the cardinal idea of having a leader, a president, is someone who might tell the truth. And so the truth was a value that was difficult to find in the recent Trump presidency.
Well, we appreciate the perspective that you share on a host of different issues and questions, and the way in which you tell so many intriguing and illuminating stories about yourself, your life, your career, and some of the extraordinary people which you have been blessed to meet along the way. And the book again is titled Journeys with Jimmy Carter and Other Adventures in Media, a wide-ranging memoir by Barry Jagoda, published by Kohler Books. Barry Jagoda, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was a pleasure and honor to speak with you. Best wishes.
My pleasure, my pleasure. And thank you for your background and such an informative question, your own perspective. I appreciate it very much, Greg.
You're very welcome. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a look at how one can possibly do choral singing safely during this time of COVID-19. Early on, we heard all kinds of alarming reports about how the act of singing was one of the riskiest things that one could do in terms of potentially spreading COVID. Eventually, it was figured out that precautions can make choral singing possible. And I talk today, tomorrow, I should say, on The Morning Show with Dr. James Kinchin from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside and his counterpart at Carthage, Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli, about how they were able to safely sing together during this past fall semester. Monday on The Morning Show, I'm very excited about sharing with you an interview I recorded with Rebecca Boggs Roberts, the daughter of Cokie Roberts, and Lucinda Robb, granddaughter of Lady Bird Johnson. These two lifelong friends have co-written a book called The Suffragist Playbook, Your Guide to Changing the World. It looks back at the extraordinary work done by a whole host of women during the suffragist movement, and they draw some parallels to the lessons, valuable lessons that can help present-day advocates on a number of different issues. That will be on Monday's Morning Show. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, which will launch an RN to BSN program next month. Practicing nurses with an associate degree can complete a Bachelor of Science in Nursing in just 16 months, taking a mix of online and on-campus courses. For more information, you can go to carthage.edu/BSN. We're approaching 9 o'clock.